Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for this discussion of the Constitutional Convention. What I hope to do with you is I'll begin with some general comments about the importance of the Constitutional Convention in 1787. I'm going to talk a little bit about the atmosphere which led up to the Constitutional Convention. I'll talk about the convention itself and the makeup of the body that came together in the summer of 1787. I'll talk a little bit about the purposes of the Constitution and then specifically some of the issues that they faced. And then we'll close with some concluding thoughts about the importance of this, this seminal document, the United States Constitution. In 1787, the original states, with the exception of Rhode Island, collectively appointed 70 individuals to a constitutional convention. A number of those who were selected decided not to attend, and they decided not to attend for a number of different reasons. Some didn't have the money to attend. There had been tough economic times, and they simply couldn't raise the funds or borrow the funds to make it to Philadelphia. Some of them were opposed to the process. In fact, Patrick Henry said, quote, he smelt a rat and wasn't going to go to Philadelphia. He was concerned that they were going to try to overturn the existing government, the Articles of Confederation. And in fact, as we know, that's exactly what did end up happening. In the end, 55 gentlemen met in the same room of Independence Hall where 11 years earlier the Second Continental Congress had authorized and signed the Declaration of Independence. The delegates who met in Philadelphia in 1787 had a distinct advantage over those who had met just 11 years earlier. And that advantage was that independence was already a fact. They didn't have to try to explain why the break with England was necessary. This allowed them the freedom to concentrate on what form of government would be appropriate for the young nation. Now, the form of government that they had been operating under for those 11 years from the time of their independence was created by what's known as the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation sought to embody a number of the ideas from the Revolution. Unfortunately, the Articles of Confederation created a government, a central government, that was very weak and in the end proved untenable. Probably the primary feature, the primary difficulty with the government created by the Articles was its weak executive. And the weak executive was intentionally weak. If you remember, the experience that these founders had with an executive was the experience they had had with George III of England, who they termed a despot. They didn't want to have a strong executive that would tell them what to do. So they intentionally created a weak executive, which, again, in the end, proved to be untenable. But that's what they envisioned from the outset for the Articles of Confederation. The government that they had created also had no power to tax. And as you might imagine, with the coffers dry, it's very difficult to run a federal government. That may not sound too unappealing to us today, but at that point in time, it just simply made things impossible. The government they had created under the Articles also had not the power to conduct diplomacy. So there was no way to establish a coherent diplomatic procedure to deal with foreign nations. And in fact, what ended up happening is the French and the British both threw their hands in the air and said, we can't deal with this government. We're going to deal with the individual states. And obviously that created quite a bit of discord as the government of France tried to deal with the legislature of Massachusetts or the legislature of Connecticut, the individual states. The states that were a part of this government under the Articles of Confederation, each of them had veto power over any legislation, over any act that was trying to be passed by the government of the whole. And as a result, it was extremely difficult to get anything done. As you might imagine, you could have 12 states agree on an issue and one state simply stop the process by using their veto power over that legislation. So in the end, really what you have, the government that's created under the Articles of Confederation, is a federal government that has no teeth. And this is readily apparent by the middle of the 1780s, when the nation finds itself in the middle of not only an economic crisis, but also a civil crisis. War veterans had not been paid by the Continental Congress. They didn't have the money to do that. And as a result, there's a rebellion in Massachusetts led by a gentleman by the name of Daniel Shays. The Shays Rebellion was put down not by the federal government, but by the government of Massachusetts, because the federal government or the national government had no authority to do so. Because of the weakness of the federal government, there was difficulty in even coming up with a national trade policy, and the economy suffered. So they're in bad economic straits by the middle of the 1780s. It truly is a national crisis created by the weakness of the government they had created. There's one last-ditch attempt made to try to rectify the situation, to try to address some of the concerns that they have with this government. And members of the various states come together in 1786 in Annapolis, and they try to agree to a national plan on regulating trade. And that's both international trade and then trade between the states. In the end, the delegates to the Annapolis Convention were unable to come up with an agreement. And it's at that point that it's apparent to virtually everyone that a constitutional convention needs to be called. And it is called for the summer of 1787. The gentleman who attended came with the idea not that they would be creating a whole new government, but that they would simply be revamping the existing government, the one created under the Articles. I'll talk a little bit more about how they come to that realization that they are going to have to throw the baby out with the bathwater and start over again. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about the body that came together. The delegates who participated in the Constitutional Convention in 1787 ranged in age from Benjamin Franklin, who was 81 years old at the time of the convention, all the way down to Jonathan Dayton. Jonathan Dayton was only 26 years of age during the convention. Benjamin Franklin, you may or may not know, was also the eldest member of the Second Continental Congress, 11 years older. So he has he's known as the oldest member of both the Second Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention. Franklin certainly serves as a father figure to many of the individuals who come and participate in the convention. And even though his mind is still sharp, he's witty, he participates in debate, his body is failing him by this time. He has gallstones, he has kidney stones, he has gout, and it's very, very difficult for Franklin to move about. He's incapable of walking back and forth between his home and Independence Hall every day. So the way that he gets back and forth to the proceedings each day is he had brought home a sedan chair from France when he was a diplomat there. And if you don't know what a sedan chair is, it's a chair that basically has poles on it, and it rests on the shoulders of four gentlemen who carry that chair through the streets. And I can just imagine what it must have been like each morning when Benjamin Franklin went to Independence Hall. You know, with his personality, I can envision him waving to the onlookers and making a real to-do about his procession through the streets. Franklin took great pride in the fact that the gentlemen who carried him to Independence Hall every day were prisoners at a local jail. And he felt very good about the fact that he was able to involve them even in some little way in this process. So Benjamin Franklin is quite a character at the Constitutional Convention as he was at the Second Continental Congress. 13 of the 55 members who are in attendance at the convention were businessmen, merchants, or shippers. Two of them were scientists. Three were doctors. One was a university president. One was an ordained minister. And three had studied theology but were never ordained. Eight of the delegates were born outside the United States. And that sounds odd to us in retrospect, but remember, we're not very far afield from the origins of the country. So many of those founding fathers had been born in England and then come to the States. And one who had not was Alexander Hamilton, who was born in the West Indies and came to the States and participated in the Constitutional Convention. Half of the delegates had attended some college, and that means that they're more educated than the populace as a whole. In fact, even those who did not attend some college were still very educated men. They were well-read. They were much more educated than the populace as a whole. Some were still wealthy, but many had lost a great deal during the war and the ensuing bad economy. Some had to borrow money or stay with relatives in order to be able to attend the convention. And then lastly, 12 of the 55 who were in attendance owned or managed slave-operated plantations or large farms. And just as it played a role in the Second Continental Congress, the issue of slavery will play a major role in the Constitutional Convention as well. Now, I said a few moments ago that when those delegates came together in June of 1787, their expectation was that they were coming to Philadelphia to simply revise the existing Articles of Confederation. Well, just days into the convention, they recognized that they were not going to be able to do that. They recognized that they were going to have to begin anew. And I can just imagine what that moment must have been like as those 55 delegates come to the realization that they're going to have to start all over again. And where do you go from that point? How do you decide to put together a government? At what point do you begin? And luckily, into that vacuum steps the gentleman who's later to be known as the father of the Constitution. That's James Madison. James Madison was a very studious individual. He believed in being prepared, and in fact, he came to Philadelphia 11 days before any of the other delegates arrived. And during those 11 days, James Madison read about other republics in history, what made them succeed, what made them fail, how they were constructed. James Madison, during those 11 days, put together what's known as the Virginia Resolves, or later it's known as the Virginia Plan. But again, Madison steps into that vacuum, and the point at which they don't quite know what direction to go, and they even discuss disbanding the convention, Madison says, here, let's look at these resolves. We can begin our discussion here. And if you ever have time to look at those resolves, you'll recognize that many of them make the foundation for our current Constitution. Let's talk about the differences or difficulties that this group faced. There are two major issues that this group has to deal with during the course of the summer and into the early fall during the convention. And the first of those issues is representation for the states. Under the old form of government, under the Articles of Confederation, each state was represented equally. There was a General Assembly. It was a unicameral legislature. There were not two houses, but one. And each state had one vote. They had, remember, that veto vote. So when they begin to look at the new government and how representation will be determined, there's a question, do we keep it the same or do we try to structure it differently? And James Madison in the Virginia Resolves suggested that representation should be based upon population. That was a whole new concept, and it was a very radical concept for this group. The large states loved that idea, because they had a lot of population. And when I refer to large and small states, understand that I'm not talking about geography, but rather population. The large states very much liked the idea of representation based upon population. It was the smaller states, like New Jersey and Rhode Island and Delaware, that didn't care at all for that idea, and in fact, threatened to walk out of the Constitutional Convention. They accused the representatives of the larger states, they accused them of bringing them to Philadelphia under false pretenses. It was a ruse to have them there and to take power from them and to make them second-class citizens. tensions were very high and angers flared as they talked about this idea of representation based upon population. Well, Madison offers his Virginia plan, and it does just that. It makes that suggestion that there should be a bicameral legislature. There should be two houses, but both of those houses would be based upon population, representation based upon population. The Virginia plan also does a couple other things. It gave more power to the people at the expense of the government. And it also tried to do away with the practice of multiple office holding. You see, quite often, leaders in that day, at the end of the 18th century, you might be a representative to Congress, and you may also be a mayor for your local town. Or you could also be a sheriff. Or maybe you're a member of another legislative body. It was not uncommon for leaders to hold multiple offices. Well, as part of the Virginia plan, James Madison said, we're going to get better government if we eliminate the multiple office holding. But really, again, the focus of the Virginia plan is representation based upon population. The response to the Virginia plan is written by William Patterson. William Patterson of New Jersey writes what's known as the New Jersey plan or the small state plan. And his idea was just the opposite. The New Jersey plan suggested that representation should be equal among the states and that there should be more of an emphasis on making a strong government, a powerful government that will watch over the people and solve problems for the people. Again, the New Jersey plan was authored by William Patterson, and it provided for the federal government to tax citizens directly. Previously, taxation had been done by the states, but the New Jersey plan, hearkening back to the Articles of Confederation and recognizing the weakness that existed there, the New Jersey plan provides for the federal government to tax citizens directly so that there is money in the federal coffer. It also sought to limit the term of the president. Remember, they want a strong executive, but they don't want an executive that turns into a monarch. They don't want someone who's going to serve for life. So the New Jersey plan suggests limiting the term of the president. They do want a strong judiciary, so they provide for life terms for the judges. And Patterson saw that as a good counterbalance or a good check and balance against the power of a strong executive. So the two plans that had been offered early in the convention were the Virginia plan, where representation would be based upon population, and the New Jersey plan, where representation would be equal among the states. And at this point, a third plan is offered. It doesn't gain a whole lot of adherence, so it's not terribly important in terms of the discussion, but it bears mentioning because it's important simply because of who offered it. And it's called the Hamilton Plan, and it's offered by Alexander Hamilton. And his offering of this plan is important because it's really his first opportunity to step onto the stage in terms of a policymaker in our government. Hamilton, of course, was a war hero fighting alongside George Washington for the duration of the war. He's a representative from New York, and he's there with two other representatives who are wholly opposed to his ideas. So it's a difficult situation for Hamilton. But he offers up his plan, and as you will see, this plan unfortunately dogged Hamilton for the rest of his political career. Hamilton had said several times that the most perfect form of government ever created was the British form of government, and he was roundly criticized for that. But he had a great deal of respect for the British system. When Hamilton offered his plan at the Constitutional Convention, it was a plan that was designed to create a strong central government like that which existed in England. So he suggested that senators should serve for life. He also thought that the executive or the president should serve for life. Now understand, he's not suggesting there should be a monarchy. He doesn't want it to be a hereditary monarchy. When the president dies, his son takes over. But he does want an executive to serve for life because he thinks that lends stability to that office. And then lastly, Hamilton suggested another very controversial provision, and that was that the federal government should have the right to override state law. In effect, the federal government would play the role of the Supreme Court in determining whether or not state law was constitutional. Hamilton's plan, as I said, did not gain many adherents, but it is his arrival on the scene as an important actor in terms of our founding fathers. The two plans that are on the table, the Virginia plan and the New Jersey plan, are diametrically opposed. And it's at this point that many of the delegates expect that the convention is going to break up because they just don't see how there can be any sort of reconciliation between these two opposing plans. The gentleman who really becomes a hero at this point and steps into the void and suggested a compromise is a guy by the name of Roger Sherman. Roger Sherman is from Connecticut, and Sherman's compromise is to take the best of both plans. In that compromise, Sherman really saved the convention. His compromise wasn't agreed to immediately. The delegates needed several days to think these things over, but in the end, they adopted almost every point of what Sherman had to suggest. His basic points in the compromise, which was known as Sherman's Compromise or the Connecticut Compromise, sometimes called the Great Compromise, his main points were to create a bicameral legislature, two houses. The upper house, which is now our Senate, the upper house would be characterized by states having an equal vote. Every state would have two senators. The lower house, our House of Representatives, representation would be based upon population. So again, Roger Sherman is able to step into this very difficult situation and offer up a compromise which, in effect, saves the convention. Now, the second difficult issue that the delegates of the Constitutional Convention had to deal with was slavery. Slavery had been a very important issue at the Second Continental Congress. It is also an important issue at the Constitutional Convention. And the question really is, how are we going to deal with slavery, because it significantly affects this question of representation? And there are two compromises that are reached to get Southern delegates involved in the process and to get support from Southern delegates so that they can come to a finished product. They can put this Constitution together. The first compromise that's agreed to is that the federal government will make no changes to the slavery laws for 20 years. The federal government won't act on slavery until the year 1808. So, as they kicked the slavery can down the road in 1776, they have once again kicked the slavery can down the road to 1808. This is indicative of the fact that slavery is such a difficult issue for our founders to deal with that they're scared that if they make a strong pronouncement one way or the other, the Southern delegates won't support the process and the nation will simply break apart. Now, this agreement that the federal government won't act on slavery until 1808 serves a couple purposes. It gives the South a 20-year period during which they can reorder their economy to operate successfully without slave labor. It also creates sort of a cooling-off period during which cooler heads can prevail and a solution to the slavery question can be found. Now, as we know, 1808 came and went, and the issue of slavery wasn't dealt with. It's not actually dealt with until the 1860s, when 500,000 Americans lose their lives in a civil war, largely over the slavery issue. The second compromise that's reached, again, connects these two issues of slavery and representation. The main question here is, how will unfree blacks be counted in terms of representation? The Southern delegates wanted blacks to be counted the same, unfree blacks, slaves. They wanted them to be counted the same as anyone else. They wanted the benefit of that count, because that would determine how many representatives they get in the House of Representatives. The Northern delegates said, well, you know, that's not fair. Those are unfree persons. They shouldn't be counted at all for the purposes of determining representation. So again, we've got two sides that are diametrically opposed. We're at an impasse. And again, there are threats that the delegate or that the convention may break up over this issue of slavery. The gentleman who steps in at this point in time and offers a compromise on this issue is James Wilson of Pennsylvania. Wilson is not one of our more well-known founders, but his contribution on this particular topic is absolutely essential. Bear in mind that Wilson is a Northerner. He's also an abolitionist. And Wilson's proposal is that unfree blacks will be counted as 3/5 of free persons. So for the purposes of representation, unfree blacks will be counted as 3/5 of a person. The Southern delegates aren't terribly happy with that, but they recognize that it's probably the best deal they're going to get, and they agree to it. Now, unfortunately, in recent history, the 3/5 compromise has been portrayed as something that it's not. There have been suggestions that the 3/5 compromise is indicative of the fact that our founders were just a bunch of racists. They were a bunch of rich white gentlemen who held racist attitudes towards blacks. And if you examine the evidence for just a moment, it's readily apparent that that's not the case. And I don't mean at all to say that there weren't those who maybe held those views, but they were certainly in the minority. It was not a majority, and certainly not the entire group of founders who held a view of blacks that we would consider to be very wrong. The evidence that I would cite to you is this. Bear in mind that it was the Southern delegates that wanted unfree blacks counted as full citizens, as full people in terms of representation. It was the Northern delegates that wanted them not counted at all. And then the gentleman who steps in to offer the compromise, James Wilson, again, is a Northerner. And he's the one that suggested, an abolitionist, he's the one that suggested that blacks, unfree blacks, should be counted as 3/5 of free persons. And then lastly, free blacks, whether they lived in the North or the South, obviously predominantly in the North, but free blacks were counted the same as any other free person. So if these were simply a bunch of racists determined to deride all blacks, they certainly wouldn't have acted in that manner. So that's an unfortunate aspect to our history that's come to light in the last several decades, and I think it's very wrong in terms of the way it presents our founders. Now let me share some concluding thoughts with you about our Constitution. It's important that you understand that from June to September, as those delegates met in the heat of the summer in Philadelphia, there was a lot of discord. There was a lot of despair. There were many different times during the convention that delegates went home. They had a rough group of 55 for most of the summer, but it wasn't unusual for someone to get very angry and leave for a few days and then come back, or some delegates left altogether. The despair that was apparent in the group is especially apparent in the letters that George Washington wrote both to Martha and to other friends. And at no time during the summer of 1787 do Washington's letters convey any hope. If you look at his letters from that time period, it's all despair. George Mason, a delegate from Virginia, commenting about the difficulty of the process, wrote the following. He said, "I would not again serve in this convention for £1,000 per day. The revolt from Great Britain and the formations of our new government at that time were nothing compared to the great business now before us." So it's a terribly, terribly difficult process that they've gone through. another concern that they had was that the public would see them as overstepping their bounds, that they had come together in this convention to simply revamp the Articles of Confederation. And they had been meeting in secret because they didn't want there to be panic in the streets if the people heard any of the discussions or arguments going on. So the people outside knew that they were meeting, but they didn't really know what was going on in the meetings. And as they got closer to September, closer to finishing the process, there was genuine concern that they may be attacked when they went out into the street and told people what they had done. In fact, William Patterson, the author of the New Jersey Plan, said at one point, "We shall be charged by our constituents with usurpation. They will see that we've overstepped our bounds and we'll be in great danger," was Patterson's concern. The delegates understood that the Constitution they were creating would have a great effect on future generations of Americans and also around the world. And on that point, James Wilson, the gentleman that offered the Three-Fifths Compromise, Wilson said, "We are providing a constitution for future generations and not merely for the circumstances of the moment." John Rutledge said, "We are laying the foundation for a great empire." And James Madison said, "This plan will decide forever the fate of Republican government." Lastly, Elbridge Gerry said, and I can just imagine the exasperation in his voice when he said this. He said, "Something must be done, or we shall disappoint not only America, but the whole world." So there's definitely a recognition that they're about very, very serious business. Now, the convention in Philadelphia is also important because it marks a shift in political leadership in the United States. There are some holdovers between the group that met at the Second Continental Congress and that which met at the Constitutional Convention. Benjamin Franklin was a part of both those groups. But in large part, they're two different bodies, and we don't necessarily think about it that way. These two events are separated by 11 years, and it's a new generation of leaders that comes together at the Constitutional Convention, in large part. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, who was such a big part of creating that document, was not at the Constitutional Convention. He was in France acting as a diplomat at the time of the convention. Jefferson, whose protege really was James Madison, wrote letters almost every single day. He and Madison back and forth, and those traveled back and forth across the Atlantic. So Jefferson was very informed as to the process, but he was not a part of the process in terms of being there. John Adams, who arguably was the most important member of the Second Continental Congress because of the fiery defense he made of Republican government, John Adams is not a part of the Constitutional Convention as well. He's off in England serving as a diplomat. And then Samuel Adams, who was such an important leader in the years leading up to the Declaration of Independence, refused to be a part of the Constitutional Convention because he said it betrayed the ideas of the Revolution. He was very much like Patrick Henry, who I told you at the beginning said he smelled a rat. Samuel Adams didn't see the Constitutional Convention as doing anything valid. He saw them as simply destroying what had already been created. Probably the most important leader who emerges on the scene at the Constitutional Convention, part of this new generation, is James Madison. He emerges as a very important leader, and as I said, he's known today as the father of the Constitution. It's important that we also understand that there was significant opposition to the finished product, to the Constitution as it was completed. Of the 55 delegates who attended the convention, only 39 of them signed it. 16 of them refused to sign the final version of the Constitution. Some of those, who were known as the Anti-Federalists, actively campaigned against its ratification. When the Constitution was completed and it went out to the states so the people could read it and it could be debated and discussed and voted upon, some of the Anti-Federalists traveled from state to state speaking against the Constitution. That's the point at which Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay pen the Federalist Papers. That's the Federalist response to the Anti-Federalists' critique of the Constitution. The gentleman who refused to sign the Declaration of Independence, John Dickinson, you know, was criticized roundly for his failure to do so. But Dickinson at that time, back in 1776, he said, "I agree with the idea of independence, but it's simply not the right time." Well, that was the same thinking that you saw from some of those 16 delegates at the Constitutional Convention. They believed in the ideas that were contained therein, but they didn't think it was quite time. And the main anti-federalist critique of the Constitution was that it contained no Bill of Rights, that it was going to leave people in a state of nature, unprotected against a strong federal government. Now, we know that the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, was added shortly thereafter, and it was added to quell some of that criticism from the anti-federalists. But that wasn't part of the original Constitution. Despite all the difficulty, the discord, the despair, the form of government that was created at the Constitutional Convention has endured for over 230 years with just over 24 amendments. And again, remember, the first 10 amendments are those that are the Bill of Rights. They were adopted just the first year after ratification. So in 230 years, we've had roughly 15, 16 amendments to the Constitution. The stability of that document is almost miraculous. The new Constitution established the American Republic as an example of liberty to the whole world. And it still serves as an example of liberty to the world today. Thank you very much.